Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio. Good to be back. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, here every Wednesday and Friday, just about every Wednesday and Friday from 5 p.m. until 6 p.m. Every now and then in the summer, I afford myself a bit of a holiday. I believe we had a repeated show last week. Hope you didn't mind. It was should have been a good one, though, because it was the entire Sgt. Pepper album. I don't think many listeners would have problems with that, so I'm hoping that you had a good time. Plus, we got to play the whole album in mono, which was great fun. Oh, let me get right to it. I forgot to introduce my wife, Heidi Morales, my lovely wife and co-host, with me here again today. Hi, babe.
I am always by your side.
This is part 42 in our coverage of the Beatles. And as you know, if you've been listening at all, we are playing every single officially released Beatles track in chronological order. I'm saying that now with a bit of hesitation. The reason I'm hesitating now is because it's at this point in time where things begin to get really crazy.
A little crazy.
It's really difficult to do anything that resembles chronological order post Sgt. Pepper. The album was released on June 1st, 1967. And after that, all sorts of weird things happened. A lot of different projects going on all at the same time. For that reason, we're going to be covering an awful lot of events today. Very little, unfortunately, in the way of music. I mean, although, you know, this is show number 42, and we've been playing every Beatles song, and usually the average show does contain a good 10 to a dozen songs. Today, we've got so much information to cover. I believe we're probably going to be able to cover very little more than just the follow-up single to Sgt. Pepper, which is fairly incredible. But as I said, at this point in their lives, there were so many different things that were happening. And this is really where the Beatles' career takes a complete, huge change. Up until now, up until Sgt. Pepper, it seemed as though everything that happened ultimately happened for a reason, for things to fall into place to help their career to become furthered along as they progressed. Now, at the peak of their game, right after they released what is considered by most of the critical, you know, universe as the most exciting and influential album that was ever recorded by anybody in the history of recorded music, what do you do for an encore?
Well, how do you follow that up?
Right. For the Beatles, it was really nothing but trouble. I mean, with only minor exceptions, things began to go really awry for the band out of nowhere. So that's mostly what we're going to be covering during this show. First, let's talk about a few things that were going on, and I'll explain why things are a little bit difficult to cover chronologically, because I'm going to read from their actual, the log book. It's sort of like a session book from
the Chronicle?
Right, the Complete Beatles Chronicle, which discusses what's happening day by day. By May, the album Sgt. Pepper is essentially complete. So that's done. The Beatles are over it. The world has yet to hear it. In fact, the world at this point is still extrapolating that maybe the Beatles have lost it because they haven't released anything for a long period of time, much longer than it would normally be. Well, they were in the studio recording Sgt. Pepper, excuse me.
Right. They're busy.
People didn't know that, though, so they were thinking, maybe they've just dried up. Now, in the meantime, they're done with that album, and they're already moving on to other things. Here's an excerpt from May 11th. It was a Thursday of 1967. As I said, remember now, this is the Sgt. Pepper album isn't even officially released yet. Maybe probably not even printed or even ready to, you know, getting ready to be shipped. But here's the outtake from the Chronicle. Another session outside of Abbey Road, which the Beatles did rarely. Olympic being one of the top independent studios in Britain, and certainly a productive one, for in 6 hours, the Beatles began, completed, and mixed into mono Baby You're a Rich Man with producer George Martin, balance engineer Keith Grant, and also who's also the Olympic studio manager, and tape op Eddie Kramer, soon to forge a brilliant artist-engineer-producer working relationship with Jimi Hendrix. This was the first song to be recorded especially for the now more or less, you know, locked-in animated feature film Yellow Submarine, which the Beatles had gotten word of. We'll get into that a little bit later on. Yet another new project. The movie was to be announced to the press on June 7th, 1967, a statement adding that the Beatles would provide at least 3 new recordings exclusively for the soundtrack. But although it was used in the film, Baby You're a Rich Man was actually first released as the B-side of the Beatles' next single, and hence never made it onto the soundtrack LP, which is why we will be hearing at least that song today. One of the very few that we'll actually get a chance
okay.
to play. The group recorded the basic track in 12 takes, overdubbed onto a reduction of this, and then reduced it again for yet more work, all in one day. The showing the words plus Mick Jagger on one of the session's two large tape boxes suggests, obviously, that the Rolling Stone may have joined in on the recording, perhaps adding backing vocals in the free-for-all choruses near the end of the song. He obviously certainly did attend the session at the very least. On the very next day, Friday, May 12th, said perhaps it was a hangover from the Olympic session, for once again, this time back at EMI, the Beatles started, finished, and mixed into mono yet another new song in a solitary session, this time in less than 6 hours. George Martin was absent, so Jeff Emmerich took charge of the control room. The song was All Together Now, which was used for the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. It was recorded in 9 rhythm takes with overdubs onto the last of these. So here it is. The Beatles are already starting to put together tracks for a movie project where the movie wasn't even made yet, an animated film that the Beatles were really not committed to doing anything except for supplying some of the music. But you'd figure the way it came out, technically, it was released after the White Album. So these songs really chronologically fall exactly, most of them fall exactly after the release of Sgt. Pepper, which most people may or may not be aware of. For example, about 2 weeks later, on May 25, again in George Martin's absence, the Beatles had their first session in another new London location this evening. This time it was Delane Lee's studio in the basement of an office building opposite the Holborn Tube Station. Engineer Dave Siddle ran the control room, assisted by tape op Mike Weigel. The purpose this day was to record yet another Yellow Submarine number. George's somewhat chaotic, It's All Too Much. At this stage, it was only called Too Much. After much limbering up, the Beatles taped 4 rhythm track takes. Excuse me. So, what happens on the day that Sgt. Pepper is released, June 1st, 1967? On this day, perhaps the most celebrated in their entire career, when Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was issued in their home country, the Beatles returned to the Kingsway studio of the Delane Lee Company, again without the supervision of George Martin, and recorded untitled, unplanned, and basically amateurish instrumental jams in a fairly long nighttime session. The single-minded channeling of their great talent, so evident on Sgt. Pepper, did seem, for the moment at least, to have disappeared. Now, those are the words from the Chronicle, not mine, but it gives you some indication of a little bit of post-Pepper burnout that was beginning to settle in. I think the Beatles, who were still obviously full of material, were kind of trying to find some new direction and not really knowing exactly what project to grab next. Sgt. Pepper, this other movie idea that Paul was planning at the same time, all of these things. I'm sorry, Yellow Submarine and the movie that Paul was planning, which would eventually become the Magical Mystery Tour. All of these things sort of like bubbling under, nothing necessarily forcing its way to the front at this point in time yet. So Sgt. Pepper's out. Obviously, the whole world is getting these huge impressions, and it's beginning to change the universe as we knew it, and it's reaching people. And then on June 14th, Wednesday, the Beatles go into Olympic Sound Studios once again in London. One more excerpt from the Chronicle here. Never a group to shirk from a tricky challenge. It was announced on May 18, although news was strictly embargoed until then, that the Beatles had agreed to be one of 2 British representatives in a television program set for live worldwide broadcast during the evening, UK time, of Sunday, June 25, the first ever global satellite link-up.
Cool.
They had agreed to be shown in the studio, recording a song composed especially for the occasion. Doubly cool. John and Paul each wrote one for this purpose. It is not known for sure, but Paul's may have been Your Mother Should Know. Anyway, and the two then decided which song was going to be the more suitable. Well, John's composition was All You Need Is Love, which was more or less the perfect embodiment of the summer of 1967. It also fitted the one and only brief that was given the Beatles by the BBC. Keep it simple so that the viewers across the globe will understand. Right from the beginning of Take One, the La Marseillaise, the French national anthem, was a vital part of the song, emphasizing the international flavor of the historic broadcast. The first 33 takes of All You Need Is Love, the basic rhythm track, and a little vocal work, were taped between 10:30 p.m. and 3 a.m. on this night at Olympic Sound Studios in Barnes, with George Martin producing. Eddie Kramer is balance engineer, and the Beatles playing instruments normally associated with session musicians and not the Beatles. John was on harpsichord, which was hired from Olympic at a cost of 10 guineas. Paul played double bass, and George was dabbling on violin for the session, all on June 14th. A couple more things. Now, let's get to what the Beatles are actually... One of the first things that happened now, while the Beatles are doing all this recording, of course, the Beatles are also in the press, and it was becoming fairly obvious on the outside that drugs were playing a huge... influential role in the Beatles' writing around this point. But they'd been hush-hush about it. Of course, there was talk about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, about the Beatles singing about how they, I would love to turn you on, the latter one being deliberate, the former apparently not being deliberate. But nevertheless, that the way the songs are being structured, going all the way back to Revolver, there was more than enough evidence to suggest that the Beatles were using psychedelics, certainly marijuana. But they were not publicizing this by any stretch of the imagination. Well, things changed fairly significantly, almost immediately, on the heels of Sgt. Pepper. I'm going to read a quote now from Paul McCartney about exactly what was happening. When acid came around, we heard that you were never the same after you took it. It alters your life and you can never think in the same way again. I think John was rather excited by this prospect, but I was rather frightened by it. Just what I need, I thought. I'm going to have some funny little thing, and then I'll never be able to get back home again. Oh, geez. So I delayed, and I think I was seen to stall a little bit within the group. Talk about peer pressure. I mean, the Beatles had got to be one of the ultimate peer pressures going. They were my mates, my fellow musicians. I remember in 1965, we'd had a few days off in Los Angeles and had hired a house in Hollywood. John, George, and Ringo took acid there, but I wouldn't do it that day. It took me quite a while to get round to it, until I eventually thought, we can't all be in the Beatles with me being the only one who hasn't taken it. On June 19th, 1967, I was interviewed by ITN about drug taking. That would be the day after my birthday. How wonderful for me! I remember a couple of men from ITN showed up, and then the newscaster arrived. Is it true you've had drugs? They were at my door. I couldn't tell them to go away. So I thought, well, I'm either going to try to bluff this or I'm going to tell them the truth. I made a lightning decision. Sod it. I'll give them the truth. I spoke to the reporter beforehand and he said, you know what's going to happen here? I'm going to get the blame for telling everyone I take drugs. But you're the people who are going to distribute the news. I said, I'll tell you, but if you've got any worries about the news having an effect on kids, then don't show it. I'll tell you the truth, but if you disseminate the whole thing to the public, then it won't be my responsibility. I'm not sure I want to preach this, but seeing as you're asking, yeah, I've taken LSD. I've had it about four times at that stage, and I told him so. I felt it was reasonable, but it became a big news item.
Mm-mm-mm.
John Lennon's take now. Who gave the drugs to the Beatles? I didn't invent those things. I bought it from someone who got it from somebody. We never invented the stuff. The big story about the Beatles and LSD came from when the British press and the TV interviewed Paul and said, have you ever taken LSD? Paul said yes, and then the press said, and do you feel any responsibility about announcing this? And Paul said, yes, don't put the film out. And of course they showed the whole film. The same type of people 5 years later are saying Paul McCartney and the Beatles are propagating drugs. We didn't do it. How dare they say we propagated it when they twisted everything we did? I don't think we did anything to kids. Anything somebody does, they do it to themselves. I never felt any responsibility being a so-called idol. It's wrong of people to expect it. What they are doing is putting their responsibilities on us, as Paul said to the newspapers when he admitted to taking LSD. If they were worried about him being responsible, they should have been responsible enough and not printed it, if they were genuinely worried about people copying. There's an illusion that just because somebody buys your record that they're going to do what you tell them. It doesn't work that way. George Harrison's take now. It was all over the newspapers. The press had a field day. I thought Paul should have been quiet about it. I wish he hadn't said anything, because it made everything messy. People were bugging us about it for ages. Somebody must have heard a rumor and then gone to ask him about it. It seemed strange to me, because we'd been trying to get him to take LSD for about 18 months. And then one day, he's on the television talking about it. Then Ringo's turn now. We weren't actually telling anybody about LSD, but the people who knew us. And Paul decided to come out and tell people. He always mentioned things like that. Public reaction was pretty mixed. The problem was that it gave the press an excuse to be on all our cases. I personally didn't think it was any of their business. But once Paul said it, and this applied to anything anyone ever said in the Beatles, the other three had to deal with it, which we did with all love because we loved each other. But I couldn't have done it. I could have done without it myself. The press started asking all those questions. Do you think it's right to take drugs because the public do what you say? In those days, we felt everyone should be doing it. I felt they should all be smoking grass and taking acid. I was 27 years old, and that's what I was doing. It was the drug of love. Love towards a fellow man or woman. John. We don't give instructions on how to live your life. The only thing we can do, because we're in the public eye, is to reflect what we do, and they can judge for themselves what happens to us. If they're using us as a guideline, we can only try and do what's right for us, and therefore, we hope, right for them. Paul, once again. I admit there are dangers in taking it, but I took it with a deliberate purpose in mind, to find the answer to what life is all about. It was a quest that the Beatles were on at around this time. And obviously, though, coming immediately on the heels of Sgt. Pepper, it shows that here they are already at the height of their game and things are going really sort of a bit awry for them immediately with the press. Also, a huge headache for their manager, Brian Epstein, who is beginning to suffer a little bit in terms of where he fits in with the group, trying to understand his purpose. But the Beatles not going on tour anymore, that was a huge portion of Brian's responsibilities. He doesn't have those responsibilities anymore. Brian very rarely showed up at the recording studio, so Brian's job really more or less was the press, controlling the press and controlling the money. Now the press situation was out of hand, for at least for the time being. Getting back to the Chronicle now and what was happening, we'll jump forward to June 24th now. This is a few weeks after the release of Sgt. Pepper. Now, just one day from the big event, which is the international satellite broadcast, the Beatles and EMI threw open the usually closed Abbey Road studio doors to more than 100 journalists and photographers for a press call that took up most of the late morning. Between 2 and 4 p.m., there was a BBC camera rehearsal for the Beatles and their 13 musicians, plus conductor, and then between 5 and 8 p.m., everyone settled down to tape overdubs onto the All You Need Is Love rhythm track, made especially important by a new decision to swiftly issue All You Need Is Love as a single after the worldwide television broadcast. Amazing to think that at this point in time, the Beatles are actually just considering the song to be like a one-off thing that was going to just be released to the airwaves and then vanish. Now they decided that it would be a good idea to perhaps have it be their hit single. So the big day comes, and the best thing that I can do to really help you capture exactly what's going on without me putting in too much of my own thoughts about it is, again, to just read the rather long excerpt about June 25th from the Chronicle so you can hear exactly how it went down that day in the studio. To quote BBC publicity, our world was, quote, for the first time ever linking five continents and bringing man face to face with mankind in places as far apart as Canberra and Cape Kennedy, Moscow and Montreal, Samarkand and Sadafers, whatever that is, Takamatsu and Tunis. Clearly, this was going to be one remarkable Beatles recording session. The program was the brainchild of the BBC, which took the idea to the European Broadcasting Union in 1966, and then, under project editor Aubrey Singer, a BBC executive, continued to play the leading role in bringing about this most ambitious, indeed historic, of television programs. National broadcasting networks from 18 countries agreed to provide material for the live 125-minute black-and-white transmission, which is amazing if you think about it. You always see the footage of the Beatles in the studio, and it's color. Mm-hmm. And it's amazingly colorful because of this post Sgt. Pepper. That was all colorized film.
Oh, cool.
Taken colorized from photographs. So the actual footage was black and white. Australia, Austria, Canada, France, Italy, Japan, Mexico, Spain, Sweden, Tunisia, the United Kingdom, the USA, West Germany, and the state networks in the Soviet Union, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary all were participating. Additionally, 13 other countries agreed to broadcast the program without themselves making a contribution. Belgium, Bulgaria, Denmark, Ireland, Finland, Luxembourg, Monaco, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, Romania, Switzerland, and Yugoslavia. All told, the potential viewing audience was estimated in advance to be around 500 million.
Whoa.
Not untypically in those Cold War days, however, all seven of the Iron Curtain countries dropped out and block only days before transmission, meaning not only that a possible 150 million viewers were lost, but that the contributions from the Soviet Union, Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary were lost also. Quickly, Denmark was invited to contribute. Indeed, the first item in our world came from there, broadcasting from a hospital in Arthus. In Britain, our world was screened by BBC One between 7:55 and 10 p.m., but, of course, transmission times varied greatly around the globe. In Japan and Australia, for example, the program began on Monday, the 26th of June, and people there watched the Beatles at around breakfast time. Conversely, in some parts of the USA, where the National Education Television broadcast the show on its network of 113 affiliate stations, it was still Sunday lunchtime. The program was divided into a number of subsections. This Moments World, The Hungry World, The Crowded World, Physical Excellence, Artistic Excellence, and The World Beyond. And each was linked and narrated in the local language for ease of understanding. Cliff Michaelmore was the anchorman for the BBC. The Beatles appeared twice in our world. The first time for 5 seconds right at the beginning, when viewers saw a fleeting visual menu of the program's content, and then at 9:36 p.m. in England, as the concluding item in artistic excellence, naturally. Their appearance lasted for 6 minutes and 11 seconds, with Derek Burrell Davis directing and Steve Race reporting direct from EMI Studios. It was, as one might well imagine, a hectic, unforgettable day for all concerned. The Beatles arrived at EMI at 2 p.m. and spent much of it perfecting All You Need Is Love and rehearsing from 3 to 5 p.m. for the BBC cameras, which were set up in Studio One. These were linked with cables by the score to an outside broadcast van squeezed into the tiny Abbey Road car park. From there, the sound and pictures would traverse the globe via the Early Bird Space Booster and Lanny Bird and the ATSB satellites. Take 58 was the all-important broadcast version, although George Martin greatly decreased the dreaded possibility of an on-air foul-up by having the Beatles play to their own pre-recorded rhythm track of Take 10. The vocals, Paul's bass guitar, and the lead guitar solo in the middle eight section, Ringo's drums, and the orchestra were all actually live, however. An instantaneous mono mix by George Martin and Jeff Emerick was fed directly to the BBC van and then to the world. The televised sequence of events seemed a little corny now, and studio tapes reveal the considerable rehearsal time which went into this quote-unquote spontaneous performance. Using material taped from 5 p.m. up to the actual live sequence, Steve Race introduced the Beatles, playing and singing the basic song. The cameras then cut out to the control room, where George Martin suggested it was time to bring in the orchestra. The musicians filed in, and Mal Evans got into the picture by collecting empty teacups. This was shown from 9:36 until 9:38. From 9:38 to 9:42 p.m., it was back to the Studio 4 for the all-important live sequence, Orchestra and Beatles. Excuse me. All except for Ringo, sitting on high stools and surrounded by a large group of friends, playing All You Need Is Love in its entirety. The broadcast took the form of a party. The orchestral musicians wore formal evening dress, while the many friends sitting cross-legged on the studio floor, among them Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, Keith Richard, Keith Moon, Eric Clapton, Patty Harrison, Jane Asher, Mike McCartney, Graham Nash and his wife, Gary Leeds and Hunter Davies, wore more typical, colorful clothes of the day. There were plenty of streamers, balloons, and humorous placards, too, and much singing along. At the song's end, some of the friends danced and conga-lined around the studio.
Silly.
Rather incredible. Beatles quotes, then, regarding this session. Ringo, "We were big enough to command an audience of that size, and it was for love. It was for love and bloody peace. It was a fabulous time. I even get excited now when I realize that's what it was for. Peace and love. People putting flowers in guns." The Our World broadcast was great, going out to hundreds of millions of people around the world. It was the first worldwide satellite broadcast ever. It's a standard thing that people do now. But then when we did it, it was a first. That was exciting. We were doing a lot of firsts. There were exciting times. Paul McCartney now. "I stayed up all the night before the show, drawing on the shirt that I wore. I had some chemicals called Trichem. You could draw on a shirt with them, and then you could launder the shirt, and the pattern stayed on. I used them a lot. Many is the shirt or door I've painted with them. It was good fun. That shirt got nicked after the show. Still, easy come, easy go." George Harrison. "I don't know how many millions of people saw the broadcast, but it was supposed to be a phenomenal number. It was probably the very earliest that technology enabled that kind of satellite link. They broadcast from Japan and Mexico and Canada, all over the place. I remember the recording because we decided to get some people in who looked like the Love Generation. If you look closely at the floor, I know that Mick Jagger is there, but there's also an Eric Clapton, I believe, in full psychedelic regalia and permed hair, sitting right there. It was good. The orchestra was there and it was played live. We rehearsed for a while, and then it was, quote, 'You're on at 12 o'clock, lads.' The man upstairs pointed his finger, and that was that. We did it. One take." Neil Aspinall, the Beatles' road manager, or at this point, the Beatles' assistant manager, since they're no longer on the road, really the Beatles' major assistant. Here's his quote. "It was a professional shoot. I remember camera crews and a lot of colorful people. It was psychedelic and all the rest of it, but the BBC filmed it in black and white. If we'd have known that, we'd have filmed it ourselves." Ringo once again. "We loved dressing up, and we had suits made for the show. Simon and Marique from The Fool made mine. It was so bloody heavy. I had all this beading on, and it weighed a ton. You can see the happy faces. I had Keith Moon next to me. Everyone was joining in. It was a fabulous time, both musically and spiritually. And for that show, the writers of the song were masters at hitting the nail on the head." Finally, we get to hear from Brian Epstein about it. "I'd never had a moment's worry that they wouldn't come up with something marvelous. The commitment for the TV program was arranged some months ago. The time got nearer and nearer, and they still hadn't written anything. Then, about 3 weeks before the program, they sat down to write. The record was completed in 10 days. This is an inspired song because they wrote it for a worldwide program, and they really wanted to give the world a message. It could hardly have been a better message. It was a wonderful, beautiful, spine-chilling record." John Lennon, finally, gave him the second-to-last word. "We just put a track down. Because I knew the chords, I played on whatever it was, a harpsichord. George played a violin because we felt like doing it like that, and Paul played a double bass. And they can't play them, so we got some nice little noises coming out. It sounded like an orchestra, but it's just them two playing the violin in that. So then we thought, ah, well, we'll have some more orchestra around this little freaky orchestra that we've got. But there was no perception of how it sounded at the end until they did it that day, until the rehearsal. It still sounded a bit strange then." And for the final word, we'll give it to George Martin, who was more or less in charge of this thing. In arranging it, we shoved Le Marzalet on the front and a whole string of stuff on the end. I fell into deep water over that, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that amongst all the little bits and pieces I used in the playout, which the boys didn't know about, by the way, was a bit of In the Mood. Everyone thought In the Mood was in the public domain, and it is, but the introduction isn't. The introduction is an arrangement, and it was the introduction I took. That was a published work. EMI came to me and said, you put this in the arrangement, so now you've got to indemnify us against any action that might be taken. I said, you must be joking. I've got 15 pounds for doing that arrangement, that's all. They saw the joke. I think they paid a fee to Keith Prowse or whoever the publisher was, and I wrote the arrangements out. Greensleeves was also there at half tempo to weave in with a bit of Bach and a bit of In the Mood. Let's hear exactly what the final outtake of that day was then. There are two versions of this track. There's a stereo version and the mono version. The mono version being the one that went out that day. Also, the mono version is a wee bit longer, about 10 seconds longer than the stereo version. So we'll play that version so you can hear the extra little 10 seconds at the fade out as it goes by. Here it is, the Beatles' first single and the live broadcast after Sgt. Pepper, All You Need Is Love.
All you need is love. All you need is love.
There you have it, of course. All You Need Is Love, the mono mix there from the single. And the single was actually released on July 7th, only approximately 2 weeks after the filmed event. Pretty incredible. Of course, it went to number one in numerous markets around the world, of course, including the United States and Great Britain, of course. And here it is only 1 month after Sgt. Pepper's release. It's incredible to think, if you look at Sgt. Pepper, there were no singles. Again, it's another Beatles album that had absolutely no singles drawn from it. It's an album project in its entirety without anything extracted for a 45 release. So, again, the Beatles love to do that. There was you can say that about a lot of Beatles albums. Sgt. Pepper is a rather remarkable example, though. And now here is All You Need Is Love, which was not a part of that album. And here it is, on, like I said, just maybe 5 weeks after the release of the album. And they have a new single out, which is now more or less serving as the soundtrack for the Summer of Love. Now, what's really weird is, as after that session, which mm-hmm. is one of the more remarkable recording sessions that had ever taken place anywhere ever, the Beatles pretty much take a break from studio recording at this point in time that lasts almost 3 solid months. There's one minor exception. They do go in within that 3 month period to lay some basic tracks for Paul's track, Your Mother Should Know. But other than that, for 3 months, the Beatles are more or less all over the map. And it's usually not always a particularly good thing when the Beatles are all over the map. And we'll be spending a good deal of the rest of our show talking about that before we play the B-side of the single. Ringo will give you some idea of what was during the Summer of Love. Ringo's quote, "In July, we all went on holiday to Greece to buy an island. We went with Alex Martis, Magic Alex."
Uh-oh.
Neil Aspinall, "There was talk of getting an island. I don't know what it was all about. It was a bit silly, really. The idea was that you'd have 4 houses with tunnels connecting them to a central dome."
Wow.
Derek Taylor, the Beatles press manager, "We were all going to live together now in a huge estate. The 4 Beatles and Brian would have their network at the center of the compound with a dome of glass and iron tracery, not unlike the old Crystal Palace, above the mutual creative play area, from which arbors and avenues would lead off like spokes from a wheel to the 4 vast and incredibly beautiful separate living units. In the outer grounds, the houses of the inner clique, Neil, Mal, Terry, and Derek, complete with partners, families, and friends, Norfolk perhaps, there was a lot of empty land there. What an idea! No thought of wind or rain or flood, and as for cold, there would be no more cold when we were through with the world. We would set up a chain reaction so strong that nothing could stand in our way. And why the hell not? They've tried everything else," said John realistically. "Wars, nationalism, fascism, communism, capitalism, nastiness, religion. None of it works, so why not this?" George Harrison now, the realist. Here's his quote. "We rented a boat and sailed it up and down the coast from Athens, looking at islands. Somebody had said we should invest some money, so we thought, well, let's buy an island. We'll just go there and drop out. It was a great trip. John and I were on acid all the time, sitting on the front of the ship."
They had to be this idea.
"Sitting on the front of the ship playing ukuleles. Greece was on the left, a big island on the right. The sun was shining, and we sang Hare Krishna for hours and hours. Eventually, we landed on a little beach with a village. But as soon as we stepped off the boat, it started pouring with rain. There were storms and lightning, and the only building on the island was a little fisherman's cottage, so we all piled in. 'Excuse us, squire, you don't mind if we come and shelter in your cottage, do you?' The island was covered in big pebbles, but Alex said, 'It doesn't matter. We'll have the military come and lift them all off and carry them away.' But we got back on the boat and sailed away and never thought about the island again. It was about the only time the Beatles ever made any money on a business venture. To make the purchase, we'd changed the money into international dollars or some currency. Then, when they changed the money back, the exchange rate had gone up, so we made about 20 shillings or so." Ringo.
Oh, God.
"It came to nothing. We didn't buy an island. We came home. We were great at going on holiday with big ideas, but we never carried them out. We were always going to buy a village in England. one with rows of houses on four sides and a village green in the middle. We were going to have a side each. That was what happened when we got out. It was safe from making records because once they let us out, we'd just go balmy. So obviously, the whole idea, by the way, this was under most of it, under the influence of Magic Alex, who had a connection through his family to the Greek military. He actually figured that he would have them basically perform at his whim for the Beatles.
Yeah.
Luckily, some common sense did prevail. The other thing that was happening at around this time, of course, was that Hyde-Ashbury was emerging as the sort of ground zero for the psychedelic movement and for the Summer of Love. So the Beatles, being outside of it, felt compelled to go there, particularly George, which didn't really quite work out so well. Here's George's take on his trip to Hyde-Ashbury now. We went to America in August, a couple of months after the Monterey Pop Festival. My sister-in-law at the time, Jenny Boyd, who was Jennifer Juniper in the Donovan song, had been living in San Francisco, and she'd decided she was going to come back to live in England. We all went for a day out to see her, Derek and Neil, the not-so-magic Alex, and myself and Patty. George, we went up to San Francisco in a Learjet. Derek took us to visit a disc jockey, and we went straight from the airport to the radio station in a limo. The DJ gave us some concoction, and then we went off to Hyde-Ashbury. I went there expecting it to be a brilliant place with groovy gypsy people making works of art and paintings and carvings and little workshops. But it was full of horrible, spotty, dropout kids on drugs, and it turned me right off the whole scene. I could only describe it as being like the Bowery. A lot of bums and dropouts, many of them very young kids who had dropped acid and come from all over America to this mecca of LSD. We walked down the street, and I was being treated like the Messiah. The Beatles were pretty big, and for one of them to be there was a big event. I became really afraid, though, because the concoction that the DJ had given me was having an effect. I could see all the spotty youths, but I was seeing them from a twisted angle. It was like the manifestation of a scene from an Hieronymus Bosch painting, getting bigger and bigger, the fish with heads, faces like vacuum cleaners coming out of shop doorways. They were handing me things, like a big Indian pipe with feathers on it, and books and incense, and trying to give me drugs. I remember saying to one guy, "No thanks, I don't want it." And then I heard his whining voice saying, "Hey man, you put me down." It was terrible. We walked quicker and quicker through the park, and in the end, we jumped in the limo, said, "Let's get out of here," and drove back to the airport. That was the turning point for me. That's when I went right off the whole drug cult, and I stopped taking the dreaded lysergic acid. I had some in a little bottle. It was a liquid. I put it under a microscope, and it looked like bits of old rope. I thought that I couldn't put that into my brain anymore. People were making concoctions that were really wicked, 10 times stronger than LSD. STP was one. It took its name from the fuel additive used in Indy car racing.
Nice.
Mama Cass Elliot phoned us up and said, "Watch out, there's this new one going around called STP. I never took it. They concocted weird mixtures, and the people in Hyde-Ashbury got really messed up. It made me realize this is not it. And that's when I went for meditation. Which brings us to the next factor in the Beatles' life. George, being very fundamentally important again, gets most of the quotes here. I had seen David Wynne again, and he had been talking to him about yogis. He said he had made a remarkable sketch of one who is quite remarkable because he had a lifeline on his hands that didn't end. He showed me a photograph of this fellow's hand and said, "He's going to be in London next week doing a lecture." So I thought, well, that's good. I'd like to see him. So on August 24th, all of us except Ringo attended the lecture given by Maharishi at the Hilton Hotel. I got the tickets. I was actually after a mantra. I had got to the point where I thought I would like to meditate. I'd read about it and knew I needed a mantra, a password to get through into the other world. And, as we always seem to do everything together, John and Paul came with me. John, Lennon now. We thought, what a nice man. And we were looking for that. I mean, everyone's looking for it, but we were all looking for it that day. We met him and saw a good thing and went along with it. Nice trip, thank you very much. The youth of today are really looking for some answers, for proper answers. The established church can't give them. Their parents can't give them. Material things can't give them. Ringo. At that time, Maureen was in hospital having Jason, and I was visiting. I came home and put on the answer phone, and there was a message from John. Oh, man, we've seen this guy, and we're all going to Wales. You've got to come. The next message was George saying, wow, man, we've seen him. Maharishi's great. We're all going to Wales on Saturday, and you've got to come. George. Maharishi happened to be having a seminar in Bangor, Wales, and had said, come tomorrow and I'll show you how to meditate. So the next day, we jumped on a train and went. Wow, the Beatles, imagine the Beatles being able to be spontaneous. Mick Jagger was also there. He was always lurking around in the background, trying to find out what was happening. Mick never wanted to miss out on what the Fabs were doing. Paul McCartney. At first, it was a big outing. We rang our mates. Hey, come and see him. It was like a good book you'd read. You ought to read it. I'll send you a copy. I remember Cynthia not making the train, which was terrible and very symbolic. She was the only one of our party not to get there. There's a bit of film of her not making it. That was the end of her and John, really, weirdly enough. There was a big crowd at the train station, and there was another to meet us in Bangor. We all wandered through in our psychedelic gear. It was like a summer camp. The seminar was in a school. You sit around, and he tells you how to meditate. Then you go up to your room and try it. And of course, you can't do it for the first half hour. You're sitting there and you've got a mantra, but you keep thinking, bloody hell, that train was a bit much, wasn't it? Oh, sorry, mantra. Do-do-do-do-da-da-da. Bloody hell, I wonder what our next record's going to be. Oh, stop, stop. You spend all your first days just trying to stop your mind dealing with your social calendar. But it was good, and I eventually got the hang of it. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's own words? They came backstage after one of my lectures, and they said to me, even from an early age, we have been seeking a highly spiritual existence. We'd tried drugs, and that didn't work. They are such a practical and intelligent young boys that it took them only 2 days to find that transcendental meditation is the answer. George Harrison. I couldn't really speak for the others and their experiences, but inasmuch as we'd collectively come through from Liverpool and gone through everything together, there was a collective consciousness within the Beatles. I assumed that whatever one of us felt, the others would not be far out of line with. So I handed over all the books about yogis to John, Paul, and Ringo. And when we came to meet Maharishi, I got tickets for them all to go, but I never really asked them what they thought or were experiencing. In Bangor, we had a press conference saying that we'd given up drugs. It wasn't really because of Maharishi. It came out of my desire to further the experience of meditation. I was doing yoga exercises anyway in order to learn how to play the sitar. I got a little bit down the line, and then Maharishi came along at the time I wanted to try meditation. John Lennon. If we'd met Maharishi before we had taken LSD, we wouldn't have needed to take it. We'd dropped drugs before this meditation thing. George mentioned he was dropping out of it, and I said, well, it's not doing me any harm. I'll carry on. But I suddenly thought, I've seen all that scene. There's no point. And what if it does do anything to your chemistry or brains? Then someone wrote to me and said that whether you like it or not, whether you have no ill effects, something happens up there. So I decided that if I ever did meet someone who could tell me the answer, I'd have nothing left to do with it. We don't regret having taken LSD. It was a stepping stone. But now we should be able to experience things at first hand instead of artificially with a wrong stepping stone like drugs. George, again, getting the last word here on the Maharishi. Being in the Beatles didn't help speed up the process of God realization, but it also hindered it as there were more impressions and more entanglements to get out of. Every experience and thought has been recorded on your life within. Meditation is only a means to an end. You do it to release all of the clutter out of your system, so that when it's gone, you become that which you are anyway. That's the joke. We already are whatever it is we would like to be. All we have to do is undo it. All we wanted to do was be in a rock and roll band. But, as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage, and the people are only players. We were just playing a part. Being the Beatles was like a suit that we wore for that period of time, but that isn't us really. None of us are. Our true nature is looking to reestablish that which is within, all-knowing. How incredibly insightful is that? Then, Of course, the news came. This is what I guess we'll end with this quote from Ringo. While they were in Bangor, a horrible accident happens. Ringo's words. In Bangor, we had heard that Brian had died. That was a real downer because of the confusion and the disbelief. You're kidding me. Your belief system gets suspended because you so badly don't want to hear it. You don't want to do it, deal with it. If you look at our faces in the film shot at that time, it was all a bit like, what is it? What does it mean? Our friend has gone. It was more our friend than anything else. Brian was a friend of ours, and we were all left behind. After we arrived there with hope and flowers, now this. And then we all left, real slow. That was pretty much it, the end of the line. How ironic, then, is it that the B-side of the single that was now circling the globe was a song that John had written specifically about Brian Epstein and about how Brian, as the manager of the Beatles, had managed to enter into social circles that were well beyond his wildest dreams before he was with the Beatles. Brian was now literally one of the beautiful people, moving in and out with royalty and dignitaries all around the globe, the man that everybody wanted to get to and touch so that they could eventually get to the Beatles. He was the contact point. John wrote a song about that, put it out on the B-side, and while that song was getting airplay, Brian Epstein was dead. We'll be back with more news about that next Friday as we continue our coverage of the Beatles with show number 43. More news about Brian and, of course, the start of the Magical Mystery Tour session. I apologize for there being some little music for this show, but as you could see, there was an awful lot that the Beatles probably wanted to say about this point in their lives as well. Here's the B-side of that single, meanwhile. We'll play the mono version once again, Baby, You're a Rich Man. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next Friday. The Beatles Spectacular is really moving. Woo! Gold Hits Radio.
Love is all you need. 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 Love is all you need.